From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Film historian Richard B. Jewell is my guest. In 1985, he published a wonderful 12-pound coffee table book, The RKO Story, all about the great films produced at that studio during Hollywood's golden age. That book is so popular that Richard Jewell has returned to the subject immediately, 30 years later, for his new book, RKO Pictures, A Titan is Born. Richard B. Jewell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
And I found your book fascinating. I really enjoyed it. And, of course, I'm a fan of your other book as well. And this is a very different look at RKO Studios. And I think the thing that impressed me right away was the thesis you have that RKO is unique because there was a lack of a central mogul the way there had been at MGM and Columbia and pretty much every other studio.
Yeah, that's it. RKO, unfortunately, never found the right guy to run the company. There was constant turnover in the executive arena. This book of mine is only the first half of the studio's history. It goes from 1928 to 1942. But during that 14-year time period, RKO had 4 corporate presidents and 10 heads of production.
Wow.
So you can tell that there was a revolving door there going on all the time, and that was a big problem from a business point of view.
And during that same time at MGM, they had 2 heads of production and 1 main guy in charge.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And most of the other studios were much more stable as well.
Well, yeah, Warner Brothers, but they had 1 head of production and a few producers.
Well, they had 2 heads of production. Daryl Zanuck left there in 1933, and
oh, right.
then Hal Wallace took over, and he was there basically well into the 1940s. And, of course, you have Jack Warner and Harry Warner running the entire company the whole time.
So let's talk about RKO. I mean, RKO, in spite of all of that, and in spite of producing some not so memorable pictures that you talk about in your book, like that one about the Phantom. I forgot what that was.
The Phantom of Crestwood. Not memorable. You're so right.
Now, just tell that story really quick. They had some kind of far-fetched scheme where listeners on the radio would write the end of the picture?
Yeah, that's right. They published the story in the newspaper in weekly installments and then encouraged people to write in an ending to the film, which they knew they couldn't use anyway because they'd already shot the ending. But it was a way, I suppose, of getting attention to the film itself.
And if somebody might have written the ending that they'd actually shot, they could have given them the prize if they wanted to.
Probably better than the ending that they came up with.
I have to say, it's a picture I haven't seen. I've seen a lot of old movies, and I do like RKO Pictures. I mean, they were responsible for some of our all-time greats in the period that you're talking about, including King Kong and, I guess, Citizen Kane right at the end of your era, and all the wonderful Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers pictures and Katharine Hepburn and so on. So let's talk about some of those. So the first era that you talk about in your book is really the... I loved how the book says that RKO begins really in the 1890s or something, before there was even movies, right? But in the beginning of the movie era, I guess the first significant guy is Selznick, would you say?
Oh, yeah. He is the one person that could have taken RKO and boosted it to the very top of the industry. He was brilliant, as his subsequent career shows. But unfortunately, he came on as production head in end of 1931, and he only had a little over a year there. And, of course, that was the very worst year of the Depression for the studios. So even though he transformed RKO's product in that year, they began making better films, and among them was King Kong. Still, he took a lot of the blame for the red ink that unfortunately just covered the account books at that time. And the head of the company then was a fellow from New York called Merlin Ellsworth, and he felt that Selznick was dispensable and let him go, which was, I think, again, probably the biggest mistake ever made.
Who needs Selznick? Let him go on and make Gone with the Wind someplace.
Yeah, let him go make some movies like Rebecca and Gone with the Wind and Prisoner of Zenda and all these other films that we still love and admire today.
Well, one of the things that I think we think of when we think of Selznick is that he's a guy who liked to make movies that at least had the illusion of fidelity to the original literary work that they were mm-hmm. based on. Was that true at his time at RKO also?
Well, I think there was a general push with all the studios then. If you're going to make a film based on a literary classic, you better get your writers to adapt it in such a way that when people see it in the theaters who have loved the book, they're not going to be upset. They're not going to feel that you've taken extreme liberties with it and ruined the quality of the original book. So I think Selznick was probably more fanatical than most because that was just his personality. He would obsess over every detail in the whole adaptation and ultimately production process.
Well, in King Kong, and of course people remember King Kong mostly because there's a giant ape in it, but I think one of the most memorable things about Kong, and you can tell us if this is true or not, but I believe Selznick is responsible for it. I think it's the first movie, or one of the first successful movies, to use music under the dialogue to mm-hmm. drive the suspense and the drama of the story.
Yeah, this is absolutely true, and Selznick encouraged that. Max Steiner wrote the score for King Kong. It's still, in my estimation, one of the greatest scores in the history of movies. Before King Kong was made, very few films had a full orchestral underscoring. They might use music at the beginning, at the end. Sometimes they would spot music through the film in various places.
It's odd, too, because silent films had scores throughout, so you'd think it would have occurred to filmmakers to underscore dialogue. Yet some of those early films in the transition era between silence and talkies are very quiet.
Yeah, well, you get a film like Dracula, there's music over the titles, and there's never another note of music in the whole picture.
Yeah.
And there are other films like that, too, where they will come up with some kind of title score, and then just forget it. You don't get any more music.
Steiner's score for King Kong is very memorable.
Yeah, it's just the score that drives the film forward. I mean, it's a great enough film on its own. Incredible special effects, obviously, a marvelous kind of mythic story, but the music, people forget the power of the music in that film.
And, of course, Max Steiner also worked with Selznick on Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm, that's right. He wrote the score for Gone with the Wind and a lot of other classics like Casablanca and The Searchers and so on.
Now, what about Son of Kong? Did Selznick have a hand in that? They made that at the same time, didn't they?
Not really. He didn't have much of a hand. He was already gone when King Kong came out in March of 1933, but he was there during most of the making of the film. And most importantly, at a time when the studio was really suffering financially, he would steal money from other productions to put into the special effects work for King Kong. So that was his great contribution. But, of course, Marion C. Cooper was the real genius behind King Kong. And he became the production head as soon as Selznick left. So he was able to then push through a sequel to King Kong very quickly and very cheaply, unfortunately. It doesn't really hold up too well compared to the original. It's more of a kind of kids' movie,
yeah,
I think, than the original. But
the writing is not there.
No, the writing, performances, the level of the spectacle, the level of the special effects, they're good, but certainly nothing compared to the Big Ape movie.
Yeah, and Willis O'Brien is the animator, right?
Well, he was the head of the whole special effects team that made the film, and they had animators, they had people working on the sound work, they had people working on optical printers and other technical devices in order to put the most spectacular special effects movie together that anyone had seen up to that time. And they succeeded.
So Selznick took money from other pictures and funneled it into King Kong?
Yeah, once he saw how the film was taking shape, once he saw some of the original effects, and he thought, this thing can be huge. And it was. I mean, it was a very big film, very successful film when it came out. But again, it came out really at the very bottom of the Depression, March of 33, when the country was suffering so much that the new president had to declare a bank holiday and so on. I think if it had been made earlier or later, it would have made much more money.
We're speaking with Richard Jewell, and his latest book is called RKO Radio Pictures, A Titan is Born. And he also wrote a wonderful book called The RKO Story. But those are the two different books, because that RKO Story is really a coffee table book with a lot of pictures, but you also had a lot of text in that book.
Yeah, I was able to include as much history as I could possibly convince the publishers to cram in. But the book is really a picture-by-picture release kind of encyclopedia of RKO's work. Every film that the company ever produced or released is represented in that book. So most of the text goes to short descriptive passages of the plot of the films and who worked on the films. And then, of course, I can't restrain myself, so I have to put my critical appraisals of most of the films in as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you talk about in your new book, RKO Pictures, A Titan is Born, is the lack of stars that RKO had under contract. Such memorable stars today as Richard Dix. And well, I like Richard Dix, but most people don't remember him. But they did find Katharine Hepburn.
They did. I think that RKO was always sort of the last of the big five companies, not just because of all of the management issues that it had, but because compared to an MGM or Warner's or Paramount or 20th Century Fox, they just didn't have the star power that those other companies had. And a lot of mistakes were made along the way, but they did discover Katharine Hepburn in the early 30s, and she very quickly rose to prominence at the studio. She was a different kind of actress. She wasn't like any of the other actresses at the time, or even ones from the silent era that preceded her. She had very special qualities about her. And they took advantage of those for a while, and then they began to lose kind of touch with what her great strengths were as an actress, and her career started to go downhill in the last half of the 30s.
Well, she did make some odd choices, I guess, at RKO, or they made the choices. Which was it?
Well, again, I think that because RKO was this studio that had weak management, they allowed people like Katharine Hepburn to sometimes insist that she be allowed to make certain pictures. And a couple of choices that she made were absolutely disastrous to her. One was called Spitfire, which came out in 1934, in which she played an ignorant hillbilly mountain girl.
Perfect.
the only reason I can think of is that she wanted to show her range, but it didn't turn out very well, believe me. And audiences kind of scratched their head and said, what is this? And started to become a little skeptical about her. And then 2 years later, same thing happened when she pushed for a film called Sylvia Scarlet, in which she masqueraded as a boy throughout the picture. And it was supposed to be a comedy, but it didn't turn out to be very funny, and people hated it. Oh, they hated that film so much. That really, really hurt her.
Comedies are supposed to be funny, I'm quite sure.
I believe that's the case.
You know, speaking of comedies, the Marx Brothers made their least comic picture ever at RKO.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. They made Room Service. It was a terrible mistake to cast them in the film. RKO paid a ton of money for this play, kind of farcical play set in a hotel that had been a big success on Broadway. And then, of course, again, with RKO's lack of star power, they couldn't really cast it very well. So they decided to go outside and bring in the Marx Brothers to play the main characters in it. So then the question becomes, what do you do? Do you change these characters that have worked so well on the stage to meet the very specific personas of the different Marx Brothers, or do you force the Marx Brothers to give up their personas that they've been building in movies since the coming of sound and actually adapt themselves to these characters? Well, they decided they couldn't do that, so they basically ruined the play by turning it into a Marx Brothers movie and destroyed the humor along the way. It was a big, big mistake.
And it's funny, too, because if you look in the TV guide and you see, hey, a movie with the Marx Brothers and Lucy, that's got to be great.
Well, Lucy was the queen of the bees during that period at RKO. She was making one bee picture after another, or when she showed up in an A picture like Room Service, she'd always be in a supporting kind of role. So she did get into some nice pictures, Stage Door, for example, with Hepburn and Ginger Rogers, and some other films, too, that are pretty good. But by and large, the bees didn't turn out so well. So she spent 7 years there working away, and when she came out, she was not much bigger as a star personality than when she started.
Of course, eventually she ended up owning the studio.
One of the great ironies of all time, that this poor struggling actress who never amounted to much at RKO in the 50s came back and bought the whole plant for her television programs.
Yes, Desilu Studios is, for those who don't know, is the old RKO studios.
That's right.
Another star, I guess, in my opinion, the greatest star in history of RKO is Fred Astaire.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how he came to the studio.
Well, people were not convinced that he had what it took to become a real star personality in the movies. They knew he was a great dancer, but they didn't think that he had the looks to carry the romantic films that would be required of him. So basically the other studios took a kind of standoff attitude toward him, which gave RKO the opportunity to sign him. Well, they signed lots of people back then, and most of them didn't work out, and they probably thought, well, let's give this guy a shot and just see what happens. So in 1933, they made a film called Flying Down to Rio, in which he received, I believe, fifth billing in the picture, but he had an opportunity to dance in that film with Ginger Rogers, and there seemed to be real chemistry between them, to the point where a lot of people felt that they stole the picture. So that perked the executives up and made them decide, hey, maybe we do have something here that's much bigger than we thought. And despite Fred's resistance to continuing to work with Ginger, they forced him then to do The Gay Divorcee, and that was an even bigger hit, and they made seven more musicals that were the very class of the musical genre in the 30s, and of course, the most successful films that RKO made in the 30s.
And they're not just dance pictures. For people who haven't seen them, I don't think there's any living people who haven't seen them, but it's possible. I mean, they're so well written, they're so funny.
Yes, exactly. They're real kind of screwball comedies with dance interludes, and those dance interludes, you know, move from the good to the sublime. Some of them are just so spectacular, it's unbelievable to watch them today that they could pull them off. But they also had character actors in them, like Helen Broderick and Edward Everett Horton and others. And
Eric Blore. I love Eric Blore.
Yeah, Eric Blore. Eric, there's another Eric.
Leon Errol also.
Yeah, yeah. And they're very funny films, and as you say, they're quite well written as well. But they would, if you took out the musical numbers, of course, it'd be big chunks missing in the films. But they would work okay as comedies without the music.
They almost all have identical plots, but nevertheless, they're unique and funny.
Exactly.
I was just watching the other day Fred Astaire doing that routine where he's hitting golf balls. I think that's in Carefree, if I'm not
yes,
mistaken.
Yes.
That's just so amazing. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he has to be a fantastic golfer as well as a great dancer.
He must have been. You know, I'm a golfer, and I couldn't do that in a million years. Not at my best.
Well, we're talking with bad golfer Richard Jewell. His book is called RKO Radio Pictures, A Titan is Born. So the whole idea of RKO Pictures in the beginning was that it would somehow, David Sarnoff, was involved, and it was supposed to tie in with radio, help radio. They were going to help each other. What was the deal?
Well, David Sarnoff was the head of RCA, and RCA was the biggest manufacturer of radio sets in the country. In addition to that, they had already set up the NBC Red and Blue national networks of stations around the country. So radio was first and foremost on Sarnoff's mind. But the number one reason that he then put together the deal that brought us RKO was that his engineers had also come up with a sound on film process that they wanted to peddle to the industry, but they got there late. And they found that Western Electric had already tied up exclusive deals with all the other big studios. Sarnoff, being a very smart man, decided to create his own studio as a showcase for his photophone radio or sound on film system, and also as a base from which to launch legal attacks on what he considered to be the monopoly that Western Electric had. Now, after that was sort of dealt with, then he began to think of ways in which radio and the movies could help one another, could be partners. He wanted a kind of marriage between the two. And there was considerable resistance to that during that Depression period, because the studio people felt that if, you know, people were listening to their favorite shows on the radio, they weren't coming out to the box office. So they looked at radio as the villain. And they didn't want their big stars appearing on radio programs. They didn't want to advertise on radio their movies and so on. So Sarnoff did a lot of stuff through his executives to try to convince everybody that that was short-sighted, that in fact these two different media were symbiotic, that they could help each other out, that they each one could make the other stronger from a business perspective. And he was right. It took him probably 7 or 8 years to convince everybody of that, but by the late 1930s, everybody is appearing on the radio. All the big Hollywood folks are all the time. Many of them have their own shows, and also the different studios are using radio to advertise their movies.
And let me ask you also, because, you know, entire books have been written about it, you know, RKO is responsible for the greatest movie of all time, according to many people. That is Citizen Kane.
Well, in one poll, it was just replaced by Vertigo.
What do you think? Is Vertigo better than Citizen Kane?
I love Vertigo, but Vertigo is not better than Citizen Kane. Now, obviously, I'm prejudiced, but the thing about Citizen Kane that people don't really talk very much about is that Orson Welles was lucky to get Citizen Kane, first of all, made, because he went way over budget, more than $300,000 over budget. People talk about the marvelous carte blanche contract that he had where the studio could not interfere in any way in the making of his films. That's not true. If he went over budget, the studio could have taken the film back, recut it, done anything they wanted to with it, but they left him alone to make it. They actually did that with his next film, which also went way over budget, The Magnificent Ambersons. So that's one thing about it. And, of course, the other thing, which I tried as best I could to cover in my book, is how close that film came to being destroyed, to never seeing the light of day because of the William Randolph Hearst vendetta against RKO and against Wells and against the picture.
It is an incredible picture.
It is. It's just amazing.
It's you know, I think everybody discusses the film in terms of, you know, its unique nonlinear storytelling and crazy shots and deep focus and all those things. But I'm always fascinated by all of those novice actors. I mean, they weren't novice actors in terms of stage work, but none of them had ever been in a picture before. That was,
yeah. That's so true. They came mostly out of radio. Wells had worked with some of them in theater and almost all of them in the world of radio. And of course, when you make that kind of transition, it's not easy. A lot of people just aren't really prepared for the demands of acting for the camera. But somehow Wells was able not only to turn out a film of just dazzling technical sophistication, but also to draw performances out of these unknown actors that still stand the test of time.
Not the least of which is Wells himself. That scene where, as an old man, he destroys his wife's bedroom. That's an incredible single shot or two shot scene.
It is. And he really, really, he was still, I don't know how old he was, about 30 years old, I think, at the time. But he really looks like an old man. He moves like an old man. He destroys things like an old man would. It's just superb. There's not a moment in that film that is offbeat.
Yeah, it's a great one. We're talking with Richard B. Jewell. He's a film historian. His latest book is called RKO Radio Pictures, A Titan is Born, and it's part one of how many parts? What's left?
Well, it's going to be a second part that I'm working on right now that will pick up the company's history in 1942, where I leave off in this one, and take it all the way to the end, which is 1957.
And Howard Hughes will be a part of that story.
Oh, yes, he will, whether I like it or not.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk about that volume when it's published.
I would be delighted to do that.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
All right, my pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. Find us on iTunes and see us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Richard B. Jewell. His book, RKO Radio Pictures, A Titan is Born. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.